Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 925, Painting Oswald Red, Part 1. This is being recorded on September 29th of the year 2016. I'm going to jump right in. People study history in order to understand the present, because the present evolves from the past, and it is only by understanding the past that we can gain a necessary perspective on what is going on today. One of the major focal points of these programs over the years has been this country's political assassinations, including and especially the assassination of JFK. I have referred to CIA officer and NSA infiltrator Edward Snowden, now being lionized once again with the release of the Oliver Stone film about Snowden, as the obverse Oswald. Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. intelligence officer who was infiltrated into the former Soviet Union and into leftist pro-Castro organizations in the U.S. To give him a left cover, he was then framed for the assassination of JFK and killed before he could exonerate himself. Snowden is the obverse of that. He, too, is an active duty U.S. intelligence officer working for CIA when he suddenly was inspired to help humanity by leaking NSA secrets. He then was trafficked first to Hong Kong and then into Russia. And whereas Oswald was portrayed as a villain, Snowden is being portrayed as a hero. Both, however, were spooks, and both were on intelligence missions. With the new Cold War accelerating in volume, and who knows, it could ultimately turn into a Third World War, we are going to take a look in this and the next program at the painting of Oswald Red. Snowden is curiously linked to the apparent disinformation that Russia was behind the DNC hack and behind the shadow broker's quote hack unquote of NSA hacking tools or NSA cyber weapons. In fact, as we have seen in our last two shows, the evidence, and we'll review briefly, the evidence is not convincing. Furthermore, Edward Snowden, who certainly must know that the evidence is not convincing, has reinforced the cover story. And what we're going to do after briefly reviewing the information about Eddie the Friendly Spook is to dip back into the past, and we're going to review information from AFA program number 15 and the Guns of November part 1 about the painting of Oswald Red. Then in our next show, we're going to take a look at the creation of Lee Harvey Oswald in Mexico City, supposedly visiting the Russian embassy and making overtures in the direction of the Cuban embassy. This by way of making Oswald look not only violent, but pro-Russian and pro-Cuban. Again, part of the painting of Oswald Red and setting Oswald up to take the fall for the JFK assassination. We're going to, however, do that next week. Very briefly, we've talked about these before, so I'm going to move quickly. From the Council on Foreign Relations blog, Dr. Sandro, S-A-N-D-R-O, Gaycken, G-A-Y-C-K-E-N, an hacktivist who now advises NATO, and German corporations and the German government on cybersecurity matters. Blaming Russia for the DNC hack is almost too easy. Excerpting this, none of the technical evidence is convincing. It would only be convincing if the attackers used entirely novel, unique, and sophisticated tools with unmistakable indicators pointing to Russia, supported by human intelligence, not by malware analysis. The DNC hackers also had very poor, almost comical operational security, or OPSEC. State actors tend to have a quality assurance review when developing cyber attack tools to minimize the risk of discovery and leaving obvious crumbs behind. Russian intelligence services are especially good. They are highly capable tactically and strategically agile and rational. They ensure that offensive tools are tailored and proportionate to the signal that they want to send. The possibility of disclosure and public perception and the odds of escalation. The shoddy OPSEC just does not fit what we know about Russian intelligence. Given these arguments, blaming Russia is not a slam dunk. Why would the country with some of the best intelligence services in the world commit a whole series of really stupid mistakes in a highly sensitive operation? Why pick a target that has a strong chance of leading to escalatory activity when Russia is known to prefer incremental actions over drastic ones? Why go through the trouble of a false flag when doing nothing would have been arguably better? And again, there is other information in For the Records 923 and 924 supplementing that. From Business Insider Nordic by Paul Zoldra, S-C-O-L-D-R-A, here's why the supposed NSA hack is unlike anything we've ever seen before. The upshot of this is that it probably was not a hack at all. Excerpting. There, speaking of the shadow brokers, their claim to have hacked a server belonging to the NSA is fishy. According to ex-NSA insiders who spoke with Business Insider, the agency's hackers don't just put their exploits and toolkits online where they can potentially be pilfered. The more likely scenario for where the data came from, says ex-NSA research scientist Dave Aitel, A-I-T-E-L, is an insider who downloaded it onto a USB stick, potentially just like Eddie Snowden did. Continuing, when hackers gain access to a server, they keep quiet about it so they can stay there. One of the many strange things about this incident is the very public nature of what transpired. When a hacker takes over your computer, they don't start activating your webcam or running weird programs, because you'd figure that out pretty quickly and you would know that something was up and you'd try to get rid of them. If the shadow brokers owned the NSA's command and control server, then it would probably be a much better approach to just sit back, watch, and try to pivot to other interesting things that they might be able to find. People sell online exploits all the time, but they hardly ever talk about it. Most of the time, an exploit is either found by a security research firm, which then writes about it and reports it to the company so it can fix the problem, or a hacker looking for cash will take that found exploit and sell it on the black market. So it would make sense for a group like the shadow brokers to want to sell their treasure trove, but going public with it is beyond strange. I would note that Eddie Snowden, however, not only reinforced the apparent myth that this was a hack, but said that Russia did it, and that does not appear to be the case. From Here's Why the Supposed NSA Hack is Unlike Anything We've Ever Seen Before, the previous article. If you ask ex-NSA contractor Edward Snowden, the public leak and claims of the shadow brokers seem to have Russian fingerprints all over them, and it serves as a warning from Moscow to Washington. The message, if your policymakers keep blaming us for the DNC hack, then we can use this hack to implicate you in much more. That could have significant foreign policy consequences, Snowden wrote on Twitter, particularly if any of those operations targeted U.S. allies, particularly if any of those operations targeted elections. And he is now foreshadowing the possibility of tampering with elections. Note the following from National Public Radio. Shadow brokers claim to have hacked the NSA's hackers. The code released by the shadow brokers dates most recently to 2013, the same year that Edward Snowden leaked classified information about the NSA's surveillance programs. Snowden also noted that the released files end in 2013. And I would note that, and due to limitations of time, I'm simply going to make the citations. There are excerpts in the printed description for this program, and still more in, for the record, 923 and 924, and the written descriptions for those. James Bamford, a writer who probably has the NSA beat, so to speak, more than any other writer, has pointed a finger in the direction of Jacob Applebaum. Applebaum is an American WikiLeaker deeply involved with the developing of the Tor network. A close associate of Julian Assange appears to have facilitated Eddie Snowden's travels from Hawaii to Hong Kong. And Applebaum also has received funding through CIA derivatives such as Radio Free Asia's Open Technology Fund. And James Bamford, in an article entitled Commentary, Evidence Points to Another Snowden at the NSA, this from Reuters of August 24th of 2016, Bamford points a finger at Jacob Applebaum as a distinct suspect. And I would also note that in a Forbes article by Thomas Brewster from August 16th of 2016, Edward Snowden, Russia, is chief suspect in NSA hack. He points out that the shadow brokers used an email account in Germany that is favored by people who are seeking to avoid disclosure. Applebaum is in Germany, as are Sarah Harrison, Laura Poitras, and Peter Sunday, all of whom figure into the scenario in WikiLeaks and Snowden's rod, the Snowden operation. I would also note that, as noted in an article from Pando Daily from March 1st of 2015 by Yasha Levine, Internet Privacy Funded by Spooks, A Brief History of the BBG. Again, Jacob Applebaum has received funding through CIA derivatives. What I see in the, what I believe is the framing of Russia for the DNC and shadow brokers' operations is something reminiscent of the painting of Oswald Red. I would note that the Obama-Clinton State Department's reboot with Russia was destroyed by Snowden's trip to Russia, and then the coup in Ukraine that brought the OUNB heirs to power, the Stefan Bandera heirs, was funded in part by Pierre Omidyar, who in turn his intercept was given the Snowden files by Glenn Greenwald, Snowden's leaking journalist of choice.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Going back to March of 1986, we're going to listen to an excerpt of AFA program number 15.
He also asserted that his real name was Bogdan Stashinsky. And that's a name that's going to come up several times. So Bogdan Stashinsky is the man, the claimed real name of this man who showed up at the West Berlin CID. And that he was a Ukrainian, born in 1931 in a village near Lvov. Since 1951, he had been an agent of the KGB, and in 1955, he had infiltrated the Ukrainian anti-communist OUN in West Berlin. After all this had been taken down by the policeman, Lehman Stashinsky made a startling deposition. He said that on October 10, 1957, he had killed Lev Rebet, one of the Ukrainian leaders in the entrance to the offices of the newspaper Ukrainsky Samostnik in Munich, by firing from a gas pistol a file containing 5 cubic centimeters of hydrocyanic acid into Rebet's face. He then calmly added that 2 years later, October 15, 1959, he had murdered the leader of OUN, Stefan Bandera, in exactly the same manner. His KGB superiors had ordered him to return to Moscow from East Berlin, but he was afraid that he would have to carry out yet more of such assignments and had decided to give himself up. The German policemen who listened to this fantastic story believed not one word of it. They realized that the man was an East European, probably a Ukrainian, and that his papers in the name of Lehman were false. They knew of the sudden deaths of Rabet and Bandera in Munich, but in both cases investigations had resulted in a verdict of death by natural causes, though under strange circumstances. Rabet had been found lifeless in the entrance hall of his office in Munich's Karlsplatz, still clutching an attaché case. The doctors stated that he had died of heart failure. Bandera, the Ukrainian leader who had worked for the British SIS, then during the war for the Nazis, and afterwards again for the British Secret Service and CIA in Germany, was found dead in front of the door of his apartment in Zeppelinstrasse in Munich. In his case, protracted investigations were carried out, since it was accepted that he might have been murdered. But no injury of any kind was found, nor was poisoning established, and the pathologist pronounced death from natural causes, namely heart failure. Stashinsky demanded to be handed over to American intelligence, and the German police chiefs gladly obliged. Investigations were conducted for several weeks by American CIC and Special Investigation Branch officers who distrusted Stashinsky's incredible confession and suspected him of being a Soviet agent provocateur, or provoking agent. Eventually, he was handed over to the German police, and BFV officers began to check his descriptions of his movements in 1957 and 1959. They found them to be accurate. Stashinsky also produced various documents, including a diploma of the award of the Order of the Red Banner, which he said he had been given for the murder of Bandera. Entries in his handwriting were found in the register of the Hotel Stachus in Munich, where he had stayed before killing Lev Rabet. And he produced a broken key, the wrenched part of which was found still embedded in the lock of the door of Bandera's apartment. He gave the investigators a description of the murder weapons, which catapulted glass phials filled with cyanic acid. He told them how he had swallowed anti-poison capsules given him in Moscow in order to immunize the effect of the deadly vapor by which his victims were killed. Experts confirmed that hydrocyanic acid could cause immediate death if squirted at the victim's mouth and nostrils, and that after paralyzing the heart, it would leave no trace. The investigations were conducted with the greatest secrecy, and no announcement of Stashinsky's arrest and confessions was made. Early in October, however, a BFV official telephoned Felfa at Pulak, informing him of the amazing case and asking for his advice on some aspects of the prisoner's statements about KGB officials in Moscow who, Stashinsky said, had given him instructions and the murder weapons. Felfa immediately informed the Karlshorst KGB office of Stashinsky's arrest and the progress of the investigations in Munich and Bonn. The Russians began preparations for a propaganda counteroffensive. On October 13th, 2 days after the Federal Ministry of the Interior issued the first official announcement about the strange murders to which Stashinsky had confessed, the press officer of Prime Minister Grotewohl called a press conference in East Berlin, to which West Berlin journalists and correspondents of American, British, and other foreign newspapers were invited.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com. Also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, before I read this part, let me just mention, it's hard to keep an open mind in these things because Cookridge himself is a real admirer of Reinhard Galen, and he uses words like the Soviets began a propaganda blitz. Now, this is not to say that it might not have been just that, but the fact that basically throughout this book, the operations of Galen and his people, most of them ex-Nazis and completely unabashed ex-Nazis, are viewed through the through rose-colored glasses, and the KGB and the Soviet Union is viewed through the eyes of somebody who regards them as an implacable and dangerous enemy at all times. So, again, you have to bear that particular focus in mind. However, it does make the book even more useful because nobody can accuse Cookridge of being a knee-jerk liberal or a leftist pansy or anything like that.
Now, a couple of notes here. Referring back to information carried in past archive shows, now, we looked at a key Galen agent named Theodor Oberlander in our last Wackel show, and we also looked at his link-ups with Bunker Hunt. Now, Bunker Hunt of the John Birch Society, Bunker Hunt involved with the Kennedy assassination, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 11. And one of the things that Bunker Hunt was involved with, in turn, was a group which he was going to name the American Volunteer Group, which, interestingly enough, was also the name of General Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers in Japan, John Birch having been the intelligence advisor to Chennault at one point, And what Bunker Hunt was proposing, and we read some material from a book called Spooks by James Hogan, was setting up, basically, assassination squads in the United States. The aforementioned American Volunteer Group was to be the name, recruited from General Edwin Walker's John Birch Society cell in Dallas. Now, of course, we looked at Walker's links with Nazis both in this country and in Germany in our Radio Free America series number 11. Walker, a former nationalist Chinese military advisor, okay, going back to the China lobby, the MacArthur Group, and so forth, again from Aryan Nations. Now, the murder weapon, which was going to be used by the American volunteer groups, was described as a gas gun developed in Germany, which would leave the victims, its victims, having a look like they had apparently died of heart attacks, and it would squirt hydrocyanic acid at the victims. The murder weapon sounding very, very much like what this Bogdan Stashinsky says he used on Bandera, and which may have been used on Bandera. The question is, who used it? And, of course, remember the Galen, Oberlander, Wackel, ABN, Bunker Hunt link. Bunker Hunt connected with Oberlander in a group called the Committee for the Preservation of Christian Culture. The Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, CDCC.
Okay, continuing on with the press conference. At the conference, a former Galen agent, Stefan Lippholz, was produced. He was a German, he said, born in 1907 at Staraya Alexandrovska in Volnia in Russia. Volhynia in Russia. In 1939, he had come to Germany, where he fought in Hitler's army and, because of his knowledge of the Russian language, was eventually posted to Schellenberg's Militaramt and became a liaison officer to the Vlasov Army. The Vlasov Army was a white Russian army fighting on the side of the Germans, which itself later became involved in a series of spy scandals.
And Galen and Oberlander, key people with the Vlasov Army, also the NTS, as we're about to see. Walter Schellenberg was head of the Sicherheitsdienst Overseas Intelligence Branch, the Sicherheitsdienst being the SS Intelligence Service.
After the war, Lippholz lived for a time in East Germany, then went to West Berlin and eventually joined the Galen organization, where he was ordered to recruit Ukrainians and Bielorussians for training as parachutists to be infiltrated into the Soviet Union. Remember, Stefan Bandera and his group were Ukrainian. He told at length of his work for the Org and how he became the landlord of the Stephansklause Inn in Munich, one of Galen's many fronts, and the meeting place of the Org's agents and V-men. His superiors at Pulak were Roman Henlinger, formerly with Himmler's RSHA, and Yaroslav Sulima, a Ukrainian who was in charge of training the parachutists. Lippholz stated that Galen had watched Bandera's activities on behalf of the British Secret Intelligence Service with misgivings. In 1956, Bandera and two of his aides, Voskovich and Benzal, were training Ukrainian agents whom the British intended to infiltrate into the Soviet Union by the way of Austria. Galen, according to Lippholz, wanted to foil the British plans, for he regarded them as dangerous competition to his own activities for CIA. Lippholz was ordered to approach Bandera's two lieutenants and persuade them to relinquish their work for the SIS and join Galen's newly established BND. They were offered twice the pay they were receiving from the British. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be, quote, liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. I should just put in parenthetically, this is rather interesting, we were talking earlier about Nicaragua, and it appears that something very similar to this actually did happen among the Contras in Comandante Zero, or Aiden Pastora, as he's known, one of the people, an ex-Sandinista who was resisting the Sandinistas but refused to play the ball game the CIA's way, was almost killed by an explosion at a press conference himself that apparently was set off by his own people on behalf of the CIA, according to later later information. So this is not an unusual thing to happen among people who are supposedly fighting on the same side.
Now recall also when a Contra training manual put out by the CIA was brought to light, one of the factors that generated a lot of controversy was the fact that one of the tactics that the Contras, of course, bear in mind their connection with Wackel and with all the groups we've been talking about, one of the tactics that the Contra training manual developed by CIA advised was to periodically single out dissident members and make martyrs of them for the cause. Now, one of the things that we're asking here in the course of this investigation is, did that in fact happen to Stefan Bandera, as this Lippholz defector claims?
Start that last paragraph again. In January 1957, an official from Pulak, whom Lippholz named as Dr. Weber, met him in Munich and told him that Bandera must be liquidated. Once the Ukrainian leader was out of the way, his aides could easily be persuaded to work for Galen. The Pulak official then offered Lipoltz 20,000 marks for killing Bandera. They had several meetings and a plan was prepared to poison him. He took his meals in the canteen at the office of 67 Zeppelinstrasse, and Lipoltz was given poison to put into his soup or a drink. The Pulak official gave him a fake passport in the name of Karl Lipnitsky, and told him that immediately after completing the assignment he could go to Austria, where Galen's agents would look after him. Lipoltz stated at the press conference that he had not been able to go through with the murder of Bandera, with whom his relations were friendly. Moreover, knowing of several killings amongst the members of rival factions, he was afraid that he might be discovered and become the victim of the vengeance of Bandera's supporters. Using the passport Dr. Weber had given him, he went to Austria and then to Italy. In Austria, he heard from some Ukrainians opposed to Bandera that, quote, the Galen people had hired another would-be assassin, one Dmitry Miskiv. In October 1959, he heard of Bandera's sudden death and realized that he must have been murdered by a hired assassin. He traveled across Europe to Norway and eventually in 1961 decided to go to East Germany and ask for political asylum, although he had never been a communist. He had arrived in East Berlin a few weeks before the Stashinsky case was revealed in Bonn, and had regarded it as his duty to inform the East German authorities of what he knew of Galen's efforts to, quote, liquidate Bandera 2 years earlier. Stashinsky's confession that he was a Soviet agent, quote, was a tissue of lies contrived by the American CIA and Galen. He was a member of UPA and had been hired by Galen to dispose of the undesirable Ukrainian leader. There was not much factual evidence to support these enormous allegations, nor was any better evidence supplied by another ex-Galen agent, Otto Freitag, who had also defected and was exhibited at a second press conference. The publication of their stories was conveniently timed to exonerate the KGB chiefs from the two murders and at the same time to discredit Galen and the CIA. Okay, before I finish, I just want to mention one more thing. We just want to insert something real quickly. Again, now notice, now as far as Cookridge is concerned, that all of this stuff has got to be phony. He uses terms like enormous allegations, not much factual evidence, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Bear in mind, though, that we're talking that in the case of Stashinsky, who claimed to have done it on behalf of the KGB, he just happened to be carrying around a broken key, which just happened to have the other half of that broken key still left in the lock some long period of time after the assassination, the so-called assassination had taken place, which nobody had happened to find in the lock. Nobody had bothered to go to the apartment. Nobody had tried to open the door, apparently, or anything. And this piece of concrete evidence just happened to be sitting there waiting all this time for somebody
almost
to prove it.
Almost 2 years. Bandera assassinated in October of 59, and here we are in 1961, and the key is still in there.
That's right, and Stashinsky is still carrying the other half of it around with him, even though it's a key that would link him to a capital crime if he was arrested by the police.
And which, if the KGB got him, according to usual intelligence, or at least some intelligence procedures, they might want to get rid of him if that key would have been able to link him and through him them to the killing. That would have been a very good way, if he was really a KGB agent, to sign his own death warrant.
That's right. So Cookridge is not Cookridge is fairly incredulous about the testimony of Lipoltz, but he does not seem to be sufficiently credulous. Is sufficiently incredulous about the testimony of Stashinsky.
Adding one detail, of course, we're not holding a brief here for the KGB or the Soviet Union or anything else. Because the Bandera murder figures very prominently in the Kennedy assassination, as we're about to see, we're examining the circumstances in detail and taking note of some of these, frankly, incredible-seeming discrepancies.
Okay, last paragraph here. Felfa probably had a hand in producing the two defectors. Certainly, he was busily supplying the communists with material in order to keep the anti-Galen propaganda campaign going. During those weeks, he exchanged frequent radio signals with Karlshorst, but by then he was under close surveillance. On October 27th, a KGB radio signal to Felfa was intercepted by Galen's monitoring service at Stocking. It read, quote, urgently require advice whether unmasking action against Galen should continue.
Okay, now remember, too, that as a result of this, Heinz Felfa, Galen's chief of counterintelligence, who was definitely KGB, was unmasked. Now, one thing to consider is whether, at least in part, the Bandera operation may have been a trap in order to do just that, to trap Heinz Felfa and unmask him as a KGB agent. By the way, he was eventually released from prison and just a couple of weeks ago published his memoirs. Now, keep in mind the Bandera death and some of the discrepancies we spoke about. Continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly, to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Reading that last sentence again. The death in Munich on October 15, 1959, of Ukrainian guerrilla leader Stepan Bandera, allegedly at the hands of Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, was exploited by Ukrainian nationalist and ABN spokesman to demonstrate the importance of their movement to the Soviet authorities, and more particularly to oppose the growing rapprochement between the American and Soviet governments. Okay? Later spokesmen for the American right wing sought to link Stashinsky to Oswald, some even speculating that they had both been trained at the same special Department 13 school for assassins in Moscow. Curiously, none of these spokesmen observed that the date of Bandera's death, October 15, 1959, was the date Oswald entered Russia. So that it certainly is an intriguing coincidence that the day, I of course recall, in Radio Free America number 13, three Americans defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. All three of them repatriated in 1962. One of them was Lee Harvey Oswald, one of Marina's Russian handlers in Dallas, who we're going to look at a little later, when being interviewed by the Warren Commission about why Lee Harvey Oswald went to Russia, gave the cover story for one of the other three Americans who defected. Now, that's an interesting coincidence. Now, bear in mind here that there is an attempt by the American right wing to link Stashinsky to Oswald, and, of course, the Bandera assassination used to build up the importance of the OUN Bandera to the American authorities and to indicate how concerned the Soviets were with him, and also to destroy the growing rapprochement between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy, but at least one of these pro-Ukrainian spokesmen, former Representative Charles Kirsten, who had succeeded Edison as a member of the World Anti-Communist Steering Committee alluded to earlier, began to develop the picture of a Soviet assassin conspiracy 2 weeks before the assassination of President Kennedy. And quoting here from a letter which Kirsten wrote, 15 days before he was shot down, President Kennedy was warned that assassins were being trained in Russia to commit murders in the U.S. and England. This warning was voiced in a letter former Representative Charles Kirsten, Republican of Wisconsin, sent the late President and his brothers, Attorney General Robert Kennedy and Senator Edward Kennedy. The burden of Kirsten's letter was an effort to obtain administration help in focusing public attention on the assassination of Stepan Bandera, the Ukrainian underground leader by communist agents. In urging this, Kirsten wrote, unquote, "The Senate Internal Security Subcommittee has been contemplating a hearing of the killing in Munich of the Ukrainian underground leader Stepan Bandera by the former Soviet agent Bogdan Stashinsky, whose German trial Kirsten attended as counsel for Mrs. Bandera," interestingly enough. It was a bizarre assassination illustrating the subversive operations of the Soviet police in the free world. Apparently, the State Department is trying to prevent the hearing. Before his defection, Stashinsky was being trained for high-level killings in England and the U.S. There are others in such training, according to his testimony. I have been informed indirectly that the State Department called for a delay of the hearings and may possibly desire their cancellation. Okay, so 2 weeks before Kennedy's assassination, a key person with the Wackel Steering Committee, who also happened to be the counsel for Mrs. Bandera at Stashinsky's trial, is warning that assassins are being trained in Russia to come kill Americans in America. And, of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, we looked at the extensive attempt to portray Lee Harvey Oswald as a leftist and talk about his connections with the Soviet Union, his travels in the Soviet Union. And we've also looked at the fact that he was almost beyond a doubt a U.S. intelligence agent who was being set up as a patsy.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Continuing with the Dallas conspiracy by Peter Dale Scott. 3 or 4 days after the Kennedy assassination, a Munich right-wing newspaper linked to the ABN, the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung, was able to publish the hitherto unrevealed story that Oswald shot at General Walker, and added to it the story that Oswald and Ruby together had been released at the insistence of Robert Kennedy. Of course, that's nonsense, and we looked at the setting up of the Oswald shooting at General Walker in Guns of November number 2. We also looked at some more of that connection in Radio Free America number 11. Either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee, of course that's one of the groups that resulted in WACL, continuing, either coincidentally or conspiratorially, the press secretary of the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation Steering Committee added to the picture that Oswald was part of a left-wing assassination plot. The press secretary was Salvador Diaz Verson, V-E-R-S-O-N, president of the Liga Anticomunista de Cuba and a former chief of Cuba's military and intelligence service under Prio Soqueras. He helped start an unfounded rumor in Miami that Oswald, while in Mexico City in September of 1963, quote, met the Cuban ambassador at a Mexico City restaurant, and they drove off in the ambassador's car so they could talk privately, unquote. Other Cuban exiles in Miami, in touch with State Department security officers, were at this time spreading rumors about the pro-Castro connections of Jack Ruby. And, of course, as we looked at in Guns of November, Oswald as well. And recall also that Carlos Marcello's lawyer became secretary of what was of the Latin American CAL branch, and also Maurice Brooks Gatlin, another key member of the steering committee, hooked up with Oswald at 544 Camp Street.
And, of course, the real irony of this lobbying effort on behalf of these people, on behalf of the Cubans, the anti-Castro Cubans, was that all of Oswald's and Ruby's contacts with Cubans were with anti-Castro Cubans, both of which were documented in our Guns of November. And as we shall see later on, the irony of the pro-Ukrainians, anti-communists, that Oswald was some kind of a Soviet dupe, was that all of Oswald's contacts in America with Russians were with white Russian anti-communists, as we will see later in this broadcast.
Okay, continuing now with the Dallas conspiracy. We shall come later to Oswald's apparent link while in New Orleans in 1963 to Americans who were in touch with the Latin American elements of the WACFL steering committee. Maurice Brooks Gatlin, part of a right-wing group at an address used by Oswald for his Fair Play for Cuba committee, unquote, attended a congress in 1958 of the Inter-American Confederation for the Defense of the Continent, CIADC, along with Salvador Diaz Verson, Fritz Kramer, Ku Cheng Kang, he's a key Kuomintang developer of WACL here, and Nestor Prochyk, P-R-O-C-Y-K, the chairman of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. All of this suggests a continuity, albeit one that may be more symptomatic than explanatory, underlying the significance of Oswald's contacts with Spaz T. Rakin in June of 1962. Recall Spaz Rakin of the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations.
Okay, we're just about to go off into the strange, bizarre, and disturbing world of Dallas's white Russian community and Lee Harvey and Marina Oswald's connections with those selfsame folks at the same time that Oswald was being denounced as having been a dupe of the communists and the KGB. And we will be following those tangled and complicated trails when we come back from a short break.
But again, from AFA program number 15, recorded in March of 1986, more than 30 years ago. In addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Note again that the Snowden operation ended the Obama-Clinton State Department reboot with Russia and cued the OUNB Maidan coup in Ukraine. I would note also that the Shadow Brokers hack featured some very clumsy, broken English, almost like Boris and the Pasha from the old cartoon series. Again, it is almost comical and reminds me in many ways of the painting of Oswald Red, in particular the supposed Oswald visit to Mexico City. Once Oswald got back to the U.S., he was once again painted red to a greater extent by being framed as a, or basically having assumed the cover of a pro-Castro operative. The following is excerpted from the Guns of November, Part 1, from November 1st of 1983.
Now recall how when we dealt with the Francis Gary Powers book, Operation Overflight, Powers was the first of many to intimate that Lee Harvey Oswald was basically a Soviet sympathizer or agent who was responsible for downing the U-2 and consequently scotching the summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Now, Oswald did indeed defect, emigrate to the Soviet Union. While in the Soviet Union, he got a job at a radio factory, was interviewed by a number of people in the U.S. Embassy, all of whom later turned out to be CIA officials, or agents, I should say. And then, despite the fact that he had supposedly committed treason against the United States and espionage by revealing top-secret information on North American air defenses as well as the U-2's radar situation, that he then encountered remarkably little difficulty in getting back into the United States. He did this. The action of getting Oswald back into the U.S. was initiated through a letter to Texas Senator John Tower, who became chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. And Oswald got back into the United States, was never indicted or prosecuted for his espionage, and was able to move about the United States rather freely. Now, one of the interesting things is that Lee Harvey Oswald began work on behalf of Fidel Castro, or at least allegedly so. He became not only the head of, but the sole member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, and as it turned out, he was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, New Orleans chapter, but he was not the only person who hung around their headquarters.
Let me stress also this point that Dave is making. Now, on one level, now remember out there, those of you who are not so familiar with some of the subject matter that we're talking about or with the dealings of intelligence, it is very important to remember that the key thing going on here is the difference between reality and appearance. And in this case, Lee Harvey Oswald, who defected to the Soviet Union claiming that he was going to give away all of America's top secret information on air defense and things of this nature, went to Russia, came back, and as a matter of fact, in the process of moving back, I believe he even received a $400 loan from somebody in the government through the State Department to enable him to finish up his affairs and to be able to get back to the United States. When he came into the country, he was never what's called a post-situational interview. He was never debriefed. Thank you very much. He was never debriefed. As a matter of fact, the only person out to meet this heinous defector who'd gone to the Soviet Union, our Cold War enemy, in pitched battle to give them all of our air secrets, the only man out to meet him was a gentleman by the name of Spaz T. Rakin, who was theoretically was a representative of Traveler's Aid, but was in fact a representative of several Eastern European violently, almost fanatically anti-communist groups who came out in a very friendly manner to meet this Soviet defector, this pro-Castro, pro-Russian defector, instead of any kind of government official who might want to know what Lee Harvey Oswald had talked to the Soviets about while he was in Russia.
It's interesting, too, that Oswald, the supposed leftist, associated with an enormous number of right-wing people. Now, something we're going to talk about next week and in weeks to come concerns the fact that the address for Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, recall he was its only member, opened on, it basically was in a building which had another entrance on a different street. One was 544 Camp Street and one was 541 Lafayette Place in New Orleans. I can never remember which was which. Which was the head of the, which was the headquarters of the so-called Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and which was an office of a former FBI agent and ultra-right winger named Guy Bannister.
544 Camp Street was the address on Oswald's literature. And again, we're talking about appearance versus reality. Lee Harvey Oswald has had a series of handbills printed up that said the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, of which he was only the treasurer, supposedly, and it had an address of 544 Camp Street. In reality, he may have been the treasurer. He also would have had to have been the president, the vice president, all the members, because as Dave said, he was the only member. And 542 Lafayette Street was the address kitty-cornered. In other words, it was a building on a corner. One corner was 544 Camp Street. The door on the other corner was 542 Lafayette Street. They both led up to a first-floor landing, and the office space shared on that first-floor landing with Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee was the offices of a detective who was a former CIA
FBI
agent who had many contacts with the anti-Castro Cuban crowd and the Bay of Pigs crowd by the name of Guy Bannister.
None of that, but Guy Bannister was affiliated with Division 5 of the FBI, which is the Internal Security Division. Now, Oswald got in a very highly publicized street altercation with a guy named Carlos Bringer, who is a Cuban exile affiliated with CIA, and this resulted eventually in an on-air interview between Oswald and a couple of individuals that Nip Tuck is going to tell you about. And this is interesting because this interview certainly laid the groundwork for representing Oswald as a communist sympathizer, if not indeed a Soviet agent, whereas the official version of the Warren Commission's thesis, the Warren Commission thesis was that Oswald was a lone nut. And when the facts of the situation are examined, Oswald's contacts appear to be overwhelmingly not only right, but far right. And it's worth noting here that there was a definite and apparently deliberate effort to represent Oswald as a leftist and to achieve a great deal of publicity with this effort.
Okay, I'm going to be reading from a book entitled Conspiracy. It's by Anthony Summers. It was published in 1980 by McGraw-Hill Books. As a matter of fact, got a lot of very good reviews when it came out, a very scholarly book on the subject of Lee Harvey Oswald and his intelligence contacts.
Summers is a BBC reporter who was commissioned by the BBC to undertake its investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
All right. Once again, reading from Conspiracy and talking first and foremost about a man named Carlos Bringier, with whom Lee Harvey Oswald had a very publicized shoving match, which enabled him to become known in media circles as a Marxist, because of course then he was dragged onto radio programs and interviewed by newspaper reporters, because somebody who was willing to go out in public and hand out handbills for Castro in those days was quite a bit more visible than they would be these days. So once again, that's the first person we're going to be talking about, is this anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Carlos Bringier. And I read from Summers' book as follows. Carlos Bringier, the exile in the New Orleans clash with Oswald, certainly had contact with the CIA. He was a New Orleans delegate of the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, the outgrowth of a militant Cuban student group. The group had naturally been deeply involved with the CIA at the time of the Bay of Pigs invasion and continued to receive funds afterward. The Assassinations Committee found that Bringier had reported his contact with Oswald to his group's headquarters in Miami, and that the information had in turn been relayed to the CIA. A document obtained from the agency, that's from the CIA itself, reveals that the CIA had, quote, past contact with Carlos Bringier. Contact was limited to domestic service activities, unquote. As we noted in the case of George de Morenschild's CIA contacts, the Domestic Contacts Division is best known for its efforts to obtain information from travelers returning from communist countries. However, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title rather than, quote, Domestic Operations Division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Let me go back and just restate that real quickly. The agency's own memos revealed that they had had past contacts with Carlos Bringier, which they claimed the contact was limited to domestic service activities. However, and I quote again from Summers, CIA spokesmen have in the past confused inquirers by using that title, namely domestic services, rather than domestic operations division, the clandestine department which by 1963 was conducting secret operations within the United States. Carlos Bringier, as New Orleans head of the DRE, also published a right-wing news sheet backed by the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. The committee was funded by the CIA. It turns out that the agency's fingerprints mark every stage of the process by which Oswald was exposed as a communist. Very little about that, it seems, was spontaneous. First, Carlos Bringier called William Stuckey, a young reporter who had a weekly radio program on station WDSU. Stuckey went to see Oswald and found him a clean-cut, articulate figure, quite the opposite of the unkempt, wild-looking left-wing prototype he had anticipated. After recording and broadcasting the initial interview, one which he would later recall as oddly, quote, deliberate, Stuckey then began planning a follow-up debate program. What ensued was a classic case of media manipulation for political profit. Stuckey found himself positively showered with information guaranteed to smear Oswald. First, there was a telephone conversation with either the head or the deputy head of the local FBI office, who obligingly read out aloud large extracts from Oswald's file. Thus did Stuckey learn of Oswald's defection to the Soviet Union. Soon, the industrious Bringier popped up again, eager to impress similar information on the reporter. He said he had obtained it by sending an anti-Castro colleague to see Oswald, posing as a Castro sympathizer. Finally, the same day, Stuckey received a phone call from Edward Butler, director of a right-wing propaganda information called the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA, I-N-C-A. Butler confided that after telephone calls to Washington, he had confirmed Oswald's Soviet connections with, quote, someone at the House Un-American Activities Committee. The very title, Council of the Information Council of the Americas, speaks volumes for its origins and allegiances. At the time of the Oswald revelations, its manager was a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the anti-Castro government in exile created by the CIA.
Okay, now we're in just a second going to play you the interview, a tape of the interview that was conducted by Jim Stuckey, Ed Butler, and Carlos Bringer with Lee Harvey Oswald on WDSU. Now, before we get into the tape, two details that I'd like to call to your attention, two things to pay close attention to. First of all, in the very beginning of the interview, Lee Harvey Oswald was going to be asked a question about his status, about the status of his citizenship while in the Soviet Union, and his reply is very halting. He stutters, but he initially says that at all times while in the Soviet Union, he was under the protection of the United States government, and then he quickly... He hems and haws and backtracks and negates that.
Now, again, just to clue you into this stuff, because it all goes by rather quickly, a very odd thing for somebody to say, or even to claim any kind of connection with the U.S. government, for somebody who is supposedly and purportedly defected to the Soviet Union because of his disgust with the United States and with the avowed purpose of giving away America's military secrets.
Also, take note of the fact that Carlos Bringer, right, the member of the DRE, the CIA-sponsored Cuban student group, that Carlos Bringer asks a very provocative question of Lee Harvey Oswald. He mentions that Castro characterized President Kennedy as a ruffian and a thief, then asks Lee Harvey Oswald whether he agrees with Castro's characterization of Kennedy. This is worth noting because the tape of this interview that we're going to play was broadcast all over the United States the evening of the assassination. So basically what you're about to hear was heard by all of America on the evening that JFK was assassinated.
All right. So once again, this is William Stuckey's radio interview, and the participants are the people that we have outlined. Carlos Bringer, a anti-Castro Cuban with CIA contacts. Ed Butler, a very prominent right-winger, later with contacts to the John Birch Society and other groups, also with CIA contacts. And Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of John F. Kennedy.
Stuckey and I are talking with three guests. Lee Harvey Oswald, who is local secretary of a group called Fair Play for Cuba, and with Ed Butler, the executive director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringer, a Cuban refugee and obviously anti-Castro. Mr. Oswald, as you might imagine, is on the hot seat tonight, and I believe, Bill Stuckey, you have a question for him.
Yes, Mr. Oswald, I believe you said in reply to a question from Mr. Butler that any questions about your background were extraneous to the discussion tonight. I disagree because of the fact that you refused to reveal any of the other members of your organization, so you are the face of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans. Therefore, anybody who might be interested in this organization ought to know more about you. For this reason, I'm curious to know just how you supported yourself during the 3 years that you lived in the Soviet Union. Did you have a government subsidy?
I will answer that question directly then, since you will not rest until you get your answer. I worked in Russia. I was under the protection of I was not under the protection of the American government, but that is, I was at all times considered an American citizen. I did not lose my American citizenship.
Did you say you wanted to at one point, though, or what happened?
Well, it's a long, drawn-out situation in which permission to live in the Soviet Union granted to a foreign resident is very rarely given. This requires a certain amount of technicalities, technical papers, and so forth. At no time, as I say, did I renounce my citizenship or attempt to renounce my citizenship, and at no time was I out of contact or with the American embassy.
May I interrupt just one second? Either one of these two statements is wrong. The Washington Evening Star of October 31st, 1959, page 1, reported that Lee Harvey Oswald, a former Marine of 4936 Collingwood Street, Fort Worth, Texas, had turned in his passport at the American Embassy in Moscow on that same date and had said that he had applied for Soviet citizenship. Now, this seems to me that you've renounced your American citizenship if you've turned in your passport.
Well, the very obvious answer to that is that I am back in the United States. A person who renounces his citizenship becomes legally disqualified for returning to the United States.
Right, and Soviet authorities, this is from the Washington Post and Times Herald of November 16, 1959, Soviet authorities had refused to grant it, although they had informed him that he could live in Russia as a resident alien. What did you do during the 2 weeks from October 31st to November 16, 1959?
As I have already stated, of course, this is a whole conversation, and we don't have too much time left, is getting away from the Cuban-American problem. However, I'm quite willing to discuss myself for the remainder of this program. As I have stated, it is very difficult for a resident, for a foreigner to get permission to reside in the Soviet Union. During those 2 weeks and during the date that you mentioned, I was, of course, with the knowledge of the American embassy, getting this permission.
Were you ever in a building at 11 Kuznetskaya Street in Moscow?
Kuznetskaya?
Mm-hmm.
Kuznetskaya is the, well, that would be probably the foreign ministry, I assume. No, I was never in that place, although I know Moscow, having lived there.
Mr. Butler, let me interrupt, and I think Mr. Oswald is right to this extent. We should get around to the organization which he is the head of here in New Orleans, Fair Play for Cuba.
Committee. Fair Play for Cuba Committee.
As a practical matter, Mr. Oswald, knowing, as you, I'm sure you do, the sentiment in America against Cuba, we, of course, severed diplomatic relations some time ago. I would say Castro is about as unpopular as anybody in the world in this country. As a practical matter, what do you hope to gain through your work? How do you hope to bring about what you call fair play for Cuba, knowing the sentiment?
The principles of the fair play for Cuba consist of restoration of diplomatic trade and tourist relations with Cuba. That is one of our main points. We are for that. I disagree that this situation regarding American-Cuban relations is very unpopular. We are in a minority, surely. We are, however, not particularly interested in what Cuban exiles or rightist members of rightist organizations have to say. We are primarily interested in the attitude of the United States government toward Cuba. And in that way, we are striving to get the United States to adopt measures which would be more friendly toward the Cuban people and the new Cuban regime in that country. We are not at all communist-controlled, regardless of the fact that I have the experience of living in Russia, regardless of the fact that we have been investigated, regardless of any of those facts. The Fair Play for Cuba Committee is an independent organization, not affiliated with any other organization. Our aims and our ideals are very clear and in the best keeping with American traditions of democracy.
Do you agree with Fidel Castro when in his last speech of July 26 of this year, he qualified President John Fitzgerald Kennedy of the United States as a ruffian and a thief? Do you agree with Mr. Castro?
I would not agree with that particular wording. However, I and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee does think that the United States government, through certain agencies, namely the State Department and the CIA, has made monumental mistakes in its relations with Cuba, mistakes which are pushing Cuba into the sphere of activity of, let's say, a very dogmatic communist country as China is.
Mr. Oswald, would you agree that when Castro first took power, would you agree that the United States was very friendly with Castro, that the people of this country had nothing but admiration for him, that they were very glad to see Batista thrown out?
I would say that the activities of the United States government in regard to Batista were a manifestation of not so much support for Fidel Castro, but rather a withdrawal of support from Batista. In other words, we stopped armaments to Batista. What we should have done was to take those armaments and drop them into the Sierra Maestra, where Fidel Castro could have used them. As for public sentiment at that time, I think even at that time, even before the revolution, there were rumblings of official comment and so forth from government officials against Fidel Castro.
You've never been to Cuba, of course, but why are the people in Cuba starving today?
Well, in any country emerging from a semi-colonial state and embarking upon reforms which require a diversification of agriculture, you're going to have shortages. After all, 80% of imports into the United States from Cuba were two products, tobacco and sugar. Nowadays, While Cuba is reducing its product as far as sugar cane goes, it is striving to grow unlimited and unheard of for Cuba quantities of certain vegetables, sweet potatoes, lima beans, cotton, and so forth, so that they can become agriculturally independent.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to interrupt. Our time is almost up. We've had three guests tonight on Conversation Carte Blanche. Bill Stuckey and I have been talking with Lee Harvey Oswald, Secretary of the New Orleans Chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, Ed Butler, Executive Director of the Information Council of the Americas, and Carlos Bringier, a Cuban refugee. Thank you very much, and good evening.
All right, and that was the voice of Lee Harvey Oswald, as well as the others introduced, and some rather interesting things that we pointed out before, which we hope you got a chance to catch, and some rather interesting things set up for all time. And one, again, cannot help but notice the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist, supposed communist with no organization whatsoever, managed to make his Marxist sympathies and his relationship to the Castro regime and the Russian government awfully well known for a man with a committee of one.
Keep in mind that this interview was in August of 1963, about 3 months before Kennedy was killed, and it was aired, as we said, the evening of the assassination. Everybody heard what you just heard, and well, what conclusions do you think they were supposed to draw?
That begins from the Guns of November, Part 1, back in November 1st of 1983, once again featuring my former co-host, Nip Tuck.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
This, again, to give us some perspective on the man I call the obverse Oswald, Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, who, instead of being painted red himself, appears to be involved not only in deep-sixing the attempted reboot with Russia from the Obama-Clinton State Department, but is pointing the finger in the direction of Russia for the DNC hack, in particular for the shadow brokers non-hack. We will continue with this line of inquiry in our next program. This concludes For the Record 925, Painting Oswald Red, Part 1. This is being recorded on September 29th of 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.